It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in today for Veronica Rickard. Coming up, you probably have several holiday feasts planned with friends and family over the next few weeks. We'll talk to a food writer about how important shared meals are to the human experience.
First, a state audit released last week looks into how mental health services, especially emergency mental health services, are delivered in Milwaukee County. It recommends some pretty big changes.
The focus is on Milwaukee County's emergency psychiatric care, something that the audit finds is not only costly, but it is not serving patients very well at all. So where do things go from here?
Joining us now to talk about that audit and possible changes coming to Milwaukee County's health services, we have Meg Kissinger. She's an investigative reporter for health and welfare at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been following this issue for quite a while now. Meg, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, why did this audit come about?
Well, this was attached to the state law that was passed in March of last year, calling for the creation of this mental health board in Milwaukee County, and that was meant to take decisions out of the hands of politicians and more thoughtfully consider these issues by mental health professionals and people with lived experience in the mental health system. So as a part of that, they decided, let's have an audit to see what should the future of mental health care in Milwaukee look like.
Now, before we get into the details, could you sum up, we've talked to you about this before, but what are the main problems they're trying to solve there with emergency mental health care issues in Milwaukee County?
Well, the problems really begin at the front door. So the minute somebody is taken into psychiatric care, emergency psychiatric care, they land in the emergency room at the mental health complex, and it's quite a complicated system. There's the clock starts ticking, for one thing, and those were guarantees meant to protect patients' civil rights. So those are important, but the reality is that the volume of people coming there, it's upwards of 60 to 70 people seen there a day, and there's not a lot of coordination. To be generous about it, there's not a lot of coordination in the system. And so what you have are people who get the short shrift. There's either long lines for care or they are basically put the psychiatric equivalent of a bandage on it and sent on their way. And there's not a very thoughtful administration of care. And that's compounded by the fact, too, that there are not adequate resources in the community for somebody who is starting to have problems finding care before it escalates to an emergency.
And as I read the audit and you're reporting on it, one of the hopes, one of the recommendations is not all of those 60 to 70 people a day need to go to this complex. They should be taken after first contact, maybe with police, into some community person-based care that isn't there right now. So what would that look like? What would the, according to this audit, better solution be?
Right, so that's exactly right. I mean, if you think about it, if you are starting to have problems and starting to feel paranoid or depressed, or it has slumped. You know, you're in a spot where you are really having trouble. You want to go into that care, you know, wholeheartedly, or you want to volunteer to receive that care. You don't want it shoved down your throat. And so, you know, if more services are available to you when you first start to feel not well, then you're more likely to accept that care. Whereas if you start to decompensate and your relatives call the police and the police show up and they slap some handcuffs on you and put you in the back of a squad car and take you out to the hospital, you're already in a mindset that is not, you know, conducive to getting much better.
But as things stand, is there that community resource that you can go to and maybe start dealing with those problems before the police are, in effect, the first provider of mental health care?
Well, not enough. And it's starting. People are, you know, after years of lip service and umpteen reports, you know, there's starting to be some movement in this area. And people are starting to see now, i.e. taxpayers and, you know, people making the decisions, there's starting to be some pressure put to bear on policymakers that they darn well better start to develop, you know, better community resources. So an example, instead of having just this one hospital out in Wauwatosa have crisis resource centers located throughout the city or the county of Milwaukee, so that if somebody is in need of some oversight but not needing to be behind a locked door and adjudicated, then, you know, there are other options, less severe options.
So the audit points out that Milwaukee County is unique in the state compared to everyone else, I gather, based on emergency detention. So when the police come into contact with somebody with mental health problems and decide they may need emergency detention, it works differently. How so?
So in every other state, every other county in the state, you need to be, the mental health professional needs to have approval by the county authority. So I start to have problems and the police bring me out to the complex. Before I can be admitted, that person, the people giving me, wanting to give me the care, needs to get approval from the county. In every other county except for Milwaukee. In Milwaukee, it's just the police bringing you out, and then that's where the decision is made. So there's a lot more coordination in all the other counties. You know, because of Milwaukee's size, it was determined that that this was a then more efficient way. But what has happened over the years is that people have become really so dependent on that building being there and those services being made available that they really don't tease out, does this person really need to be forced into care, or is this something that we can manage in a different way?
Now, there's been talk that this centralized mental health complex maybe isn't needed at all. It needs to be replaced with what you were mentioning, more dispersed community-based approaches. Does this audit back that up? Are they saying we need to move away from this complex, maybe even shut it down?
It raises that possibility. It doesn't come to any conclusions on that, but it urges, you know, that question to be further explored and lays out a number of scenarios, one of them being just closing the complex altogether and outsourcing all, you know, the care as is done in places like Dane County. So so those are options that are being considered. And, you know, now the Mental Health Board in Milwaukee County is aggressively looking at other options, including building a new facility. So they don't need that clunky building that is there now that was opened in 1979 at the time, considered state-of-the-art, but that was a while ago, and it's less than half occupied now, and that offers its own issues with long hallways and really the design of which is kind of a barrier to good modern psychiatric care.
Now, another piece of the puzzle in situations where there's a mental health emergency, as you've mentioned, the police are very often involved in that situation. We heard from Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett last week talking about new training he's implemented to help officers deal with mental health emergencies. How does that fit into all this?
Right. Well, I think that's one of the most exciting things to come out of mental health care in Milwaukee for a long time. And it came for a very sad reason, mm-hmm. you know, the Dontre Hamilton shooting death, and it was the Hamilton family that went to the city and said, we really need to see training for police officers. And we've been, you know, banging this drum at the newspaper for quite some time that the Milwaukee Police Force, you know, had in the neighborhood of 20% of the officers were trained in this crisis intervention team approach, which is the gold standard. Anyway, it's a fantastic idea. Now, does that mean that every police officer is going to be a mental health expert? Absolutely not. But 40 hours of training in what psychiatric illness looks like and what the medications are used and how to de-escalate a tense situation, you know, I can only think that that's going to be very helpful. So that was a fantastic development that happened just last week.
And Meg, I'm sure we'll be calling you in 2015 as this story keeps developing. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That was Meg Kissinger. She's an investigative reporter for health and welfare at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A recent U.S. Department of Justice memo opens the doors for marijuana legalization on tribal land, even in states like Wisconsin, where the drug is illegal. But as Maureen McCollum reports, the state's 11 tribal nations may not be growing or selling marijuana anytime soon.
As recreational and medical marijuana laws evolve across the country, tribal nations have been asking what it means for them. The DOJ issued a policy statement suggesting that U.S. attorneys will not prosecute marijuana laws on Native American land if a tribe decides to grow and sell it. But there's still some confusion about that memo, and many are seeking additional guidance from the federal government.
And the way I'm interpreting this is that we still have the authority to enforce these laws.
John Vaudrey is the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin. Marijuana is still federally prohibited, and he says he has the jurisdiction to prosecute drug crimes on tribal lands. But if a tribal nation is interested in legalizing the drug, Vaudrey says he would meet with leaders.
I would sit down and start a dialogue immediately. They know it. I'll get in the car tomorrow and drive to Red Cliff all the way up to Bayfield. So we'd talk about it.
Vaudrey says none of Wisconsin's tribal nations have approached him about this yet, but he has heard of companies approaching tribes, selling the idea of legalization as a way to make money. The issue is further complicated by the fact that marijuana is still illegal under state law. Outgoing Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says regardless what the DOJ decides, he'd tell law enforcement to continue pursuing marijuana cases on tribal lands until the state legislature legalizes it. At the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in northern Wisconsin, officials have been intensely cracking down on drug use. Last year, they issued an unprecedented state of emergency to deal with drugs after a rise in overdoses, suicides, and crime. Since then, about 85 non-tribal members caught selling or using drugs on the reservation have been banished. A drug and alcohol treatment facility for tribal members is under construction. That being said, Lac du Flambeau spokesman Brandon Tomes says leaders are not talking about legalizing marijuana anytime soon.
What kind of message would that send to those people suffering right now that we're trying to help? And especially, what kind of message would it send to our young people? You know, the ravages of drugs and alcohol have been felt in Indian country, and I think our tribe in particular is really doing its best to solve some of those issues.
Within the Ho-Chunk Nation, leaders have not taken up the marijuana legalization issue formally. President John Greendeer says the tribe has been working hard at promoting healthy lifestyles and cutting back on high levels of addiction, obesity, and diabetes. He says legalizing marijuana doesn't fit in with those efforts right now.
I don't think there really is a lot of information that supports both the medical use or what ends up typically happening is the recreational use. And that's kind of something that we've been working steadfastly against in our communities.
Greendeer says tribes elsewhere could legalize marijuana as a way to flex their muscle at the federal government. He says other tribes could benefit economically. Greendeer says the Ho-Chunk Nation doesn't feel that's a good enough reason at this point.
I don't want to see our nation as being known for the nation that can grow pot for everybody. And I think that is a tremendous disservice to the decades of the reputable imaging that our former leaders have done to promote the wellness that our tribe has been known for.
The Menominee Nation, Mohican Nation Stockbridge-Munsee Band, Oneida Nation, and Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa also say they're not considering marijuana legalization at this time. Five other tribes did not respond to questions on the issue. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
We all know what food's for, right? It's nourishment, nutrition, fuel. For every other species, that's more or less the end of the story when it comes to food. But as our next guest writes, for humans, food plays a much bigger role.
We're the only species that shares food as more than just a way to stay alive. Food is kind of a social glue. You don't see dogs sitting around a table eating a Christmas dinner together.
Playing poker,
maybe. It's part of what makes us humans, part of what makes a human a human.
At a time when you're probably gathering with family and friends to share important holiday meals over the next few weeks, we thought it'd be a good time to examine the role that food plays in our lives and what makes us human. Rebecca Roop joins us now. She writes for National Geographic. She's the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, A History of Garden Vegetables. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Wow, thank you so much for having me.
Well, do we have...
Always fun to talk to Wisconsin.
It is. I do it every day, and I love it. Well, are we overstating it? I mean, is food a central part, apart from the nutritional side, a central part of human life, of human society?
A lot of anthropologists say yes. That it's actually one of the things that distinguishes us as human beings from all the other animals. You know, we're the only animals that celebrate by gathering food, by sitting around together and using sharing food as a means of communication. There's one theory that says that all of the fundamental human essentials, things like our kinship systems, spoken language, technology, think of cooking, even ethics, may have come from our habit of sharing food. You know, we had to go out and get it, bring it home, prepare it, and divvy it up.
So sharing food is a key part of our evolution, maybe physically, but also socially as a species?
Absolutely.
So how long do we know that humans have been sharing meals like this in this social way?
Well, we know that the earliest hearths, which indicate that we were cooking and sharing food preparation and meals, you know, go back, you know, at least 500,000 or 600,000 years, and possibly close to 2 million years, based on some fairly recent discoveries in South Africa, which look like we might have been cooking a lot even before there were people. So our nearest ancestors may also have shared meals.
Well, let's move to the modern day now. That's kind of how we got here. What are the benefits today of sharing a meal, maybe as a family?
Well, they say that the benefits to kids particularly are phenomenal. People develop stronger family bonds, communicate better with each other. Sharing meals is a way of passing on your values and traditions, and healthy eating habits. People tend to eat better if they eat family meals, as opposed to, you know, sprawling on the couch with your bag of Cheetos and a beer. And the kids who share family meals tend to have better social skills. And as teens, they get along better with their parents, do better in school. There are lower incidences of depression, obesity, drug and alcohol abuse. Though, of course, you know, a family meal isn't a cure-all to all family problems. You know, if you're hurling plates at each other all day, just suddenly sitting down around the table and passing the macaroni and cheese isn't going to solve all problems. But it certainly has a lot of social and psychological benefits.
There's a concern that I see a lot, an idea that, okay, there was a golden age back in the day. We sat down for that family dinner 7 days a week or close to, and now we don't, or at least we do it less. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, the statistics indicate that we're all a lot busier. Our schedules are a lot more packed. It's really hard to get all of us together around a family dinner table each and every night. You know, we've moved on from Leave It to Beaver. The statistics show that Americans eat one out of every five meals in the car. One in four
Wow.
Americans eats a fast food meal every single day. And then the numbers kind of vary. One poll showed that about 30% of people sit down to dinner as a family group each and every night. And then about 50% manage to share maybe four meals a week, which, I think that's pretty good.
Well, and now we're at the holidays, and a lot of traditions surround that. Can you talk about some of the variety of holiday traditions that we might run into in this country, maybe around the world?
Oh, goodness, holiday traditions. Inevitably, one holiday tradition is a massive shared meal, you know, which is more than just an everyday family meal. It's what you would call a feast, a banquet, a dinner party. So it's not just the nuclear family group. It's your extended family, friends, acquaintances, neighbors. So this is, bigger, usually more formal than the average sit-around-the-table family meal. And these can be absolutely wonderful. You know, it's a chance to see people that you haven't in a long time and share food, and share particularly special and delicious food, which we often make a centerpiece of big dinners and family feasts.
And one thing that I love about the traditions here in the U.S. is that the choices are often that marker of our ethnic heritage. I'm thinking of the Polish side of my family. Pierogies always show up. There's a big production to make the Christmas pierogies. Do you have a unique holiday food, Rebecca?
Well, you know, one of the unique holiday foods around here in northern Vermont, you know, we're right on the border of Quebec, is pork pie. A lot of people eat that. It's a traditional French food.
Well, count me in. I think I'll give that a try. We're talking to food writer Rebecca Roop, talking about the role sharing meals has played, well, in our development as humans and plays in our daily lives with the family dinner and our annual holiday traditions as well.
We want to hear from you as well. What foods are important to you and your family? What's on your table this holiday season? What are your holiday feast traditions? Do you have a special meal that you make every year for the holidays? And do you have any recipes that are legendary in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold. We're continuing our conversation with food writer Rebecca Roop about the role shared meals have played in human history.
And we're taking your calls to what foods are important to your family's traditions, whether at the dinner table on any given day or maybe a special holiday tradition. Is there a food that, you know, if it wasn't there for the particular holiday, it wouldn't count, wouldn't be a real holiday? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Chris on the line in Portage. Chris, hi.
Hi, I'm in Portage, but I'm from Cambria, and we have two recipes that are musts for the holidays. The first one is a mango curry cheese ball. And it's made with cheddar cheese, and then you put onions and you put cream cheese, and then you cover it with curry, Worcestershire, Tabasco, and mango chutney.
Okay, Chris, I'm going to stop you on that one for a minute. Cheese balls, sure, in Wisconsin. Where did the mango curry part of it come from?
We were touring a plantation in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the owner and my husband hit it off. And they ended up visiting after tour hours, and he shared this recipe with my husband. And for years, he wouldn't give it out. But now everyone, it's gone viral pretty much.
Brilliant. And then you had another recipe, Chris.
I do. George Washington eggnog, and it's made with lots of eggs, heavy cream, sugar, and then lots of liquor. And we make it every year, and it's very smooth and wonderful, and it's for adults only.
I guess so. Well, is that a big production, making your own nog?
It was something that my husband actually passed away, but he did it every year, and the tradition continues. Like, all the nieces and nephews have called me for the recipe, so it'll be at every holiday home this year, so that'll be nice.
Wonderful. Well, Chris, thank you so much for the call. Rebecca, there are these, I guess, invented traditions, these found traditions that people maybe stumble across, like that mango curry cheese. Is that a common? Do a lot of families have a story like that?
I'm sure they do. And, you know, think of all the things that we used to run into as kids. You know, fruitcake.
Yeah.
Fruitcake was always like a running joke in certainly my family. So I've just learned that fruitcakes, which we always sort of thought should be used as doorstops, can be basically really delicious and yummy, and have this fascinating, huge, long history. So I clearly am a person who has never appreciated fruitcake as it deserves to be appreciated.
Well, is this something that's, you know, maybe when you buy it from the fundraiser from the church or school, maybe it's not so tasty, but if you actually go to the trouble of making your own, you can really jazz up an awesome fruitcake?
You absolutely can. Some people say that the fruitcake really fell from favor in the early 20th century when fruitcake started being made commercially. Mm. So they were sort of dry, tasteless bricks. But if you make them yourself and use dried fruit instead of that, you know, day-glow orange and green candied fruit that's often found in supermarkets, and, of course, soak them in enough not-for-children brandy, rum, or whiskey, you know, they can be absolutely scrumptious.
Well, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. If you swing by the studio, bring some of that mango curry cheese dip and some of the nog to wash it down. Back to our callers now. We've got Deborah on the line with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. This is not what I originally planned on saying, but she reminded me that last caller or the person just mentioning the guest, I mean your guest who mentioned fruitcakes. When I lived in Dallas part-time during the one winter, I worked for this lady who baked fruitcakes out of her house. And there was like eight people, like young teenagers there, and she charged $50 a fruitcake, and she put a pint of rum in each one, and Federal Express was there all day long. I don't know. I don't think she put the traditional fruit in it, but there's a little inspiration for somebody to start for a startup business. But my mom cooked a meal every single night of my life. I know because I did the dishes. Me and my sister would trade nights. But I remember a couple sayings. The Solis up the street had a grace. It was rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, yay God. And I always thought that was funny. And then my dad would say, eat every bean and pea on your plate. And that was funny to us. And we hated our vegetables. But the most important thing is the memories. And, you know, although kids don't think it's important when it's happening, and that goes for all events, when they grow up, it becomes very, very important. So I have to say, yeah, sitting down and eating a meal is with your family is awesome.
Deborah, thanks. What an interesting point, Rebecca, the idea that, okay, this is happening for the kids. They don't know it's a big deal. They don't know they're being passed on society and culture in meal form. It doesn't occur to us until we're grown-ups and look back.
No, and, you know, when you think of it, it's really an essential part of being brought up. I think table manners is a big deal. You know, if you've got reasonable table manners, if you know, you know, how to eat politely, I mean, this can have an impact on your life. You know, you're going to spend the rest of your life going out to dinner with, you know, potential loved ones, potential employers, and, you know, you don't want to eat your mashed potatoes with your fingers.
Sadly, one of my family's lasting traditions was my mom's frustration with the rest of us for not picking up any of those table manners, no matter how hard she tried. There were a lot of great moments in that. So still, we never quite got the table manners right, but a lot of good memories anyway. Back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line with us in Princeton. Mike, hi there.
Hello, good evening. We used to have a great Christmas tradition that we would have my grandmother's Croatian sweetbread, which was called bogači or pagači. And it was a great giant loaf, and it took her all day to make. It was like a dozen eggs and a pound of butter and 10 cups of flour. And everybody couldn't wait to get to Grandma's pagači.
Mike, I got to ask you now, have other people picked up Grandma's recipe since then?
Of my four brothers and four sisters, I'm the only one who makes it now.
Okay, and are you going to try to pass that tradition along yourself?
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody says whenever I come to a holiday gathering, Mike, did you bring the bagachi?
Mike, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing that story. Again, our traditions live on from generation to generation, these foods, Rebecca.
Yes, they do. I'm remembering my grandmother always made a special cookie that nobody has ever been able to reproduce because the recipe was from a cookbook that I think belonged to her grandmother, and it was a wood stove cookery. So these wonderful sugar cookies, none of us since have been able to figure out how to get them just chewy and yummy enough.
Now, a lot of us, as we approach the holidays, if we're cooking for a big crew, the positives may not loom so large in our minds as the hassle and the work that we have to do going into it. Can you give a pep talk that yeah, maybe it's worth the work to bring this feast together for everybody?
I think it's definitely worth the work. People will remember this forever, and it's a time of once you get this food to the table, it's a time of such warmth and sharing and togetherness, at least ideally, that I think it's something we should all aim for.
Now, you mentioned the pork pie. What else do you have, Rebecca, holidays or not, that you think of as, you know, maybe a trademark thing or like a thing with a story to it and a tradition to it for your friends and family?
Oh, something that we do with a tradition are just in general. One of the things my family does is, as a tradition is attempts to do something new every year for Christmas Eve dinner. You know, when we've done Cioppino, we're doing surprise Indian food this year, which I don't know much about yet since my sons are cooking it.
Well, that's amazing, a tradition of doing something different each time.
Untraditional.
And do people do people buy into it? Are they getting into that? Are they open to the experimentation? Or are they saying, "Oh, what happened to the pork pie?"
You know, there's some of each, I would say.
All right. Well, Rebecca,
as long as they get chocolate covered peanut butter balls, they're happy.
Oh yeah, actually, Veronica Rickert, our regular co-host here, made some of those for the Central Time staff. I was very happy to see them because my aunt usually made them, and I was notorious for eating like a plateful of them at a time. Rebecca, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks a million. This was great. Happy holidays.
To you too. We've been talking to Rebecca Roop. She's a National Geographic author, a food writer. Her books include How Carrots Won the Trojan War. That's a history of garden vegetables.
America's farmers are growing older. According to the latest USDA farm census, the average age of a farmer is now 58. That's 7 years older than in the 1980s.
But that's just the average age of farm operators. When we look at farm owners, their average age is now 70 and over. At the same time, new farmers trying to get into the business, they're finding that land is often expensive and hard to find.
Lindsay Rabin joins us right now. She's a consultant to beginning farmers and an organizer with New Organic Stewards, a project called Renewing Countryside and the Midwest Organic and Sustainable Education Service, or MOSES. Lindsay, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So there is a change going on in farming. It appears that the average age of farmers is going up, and the people who own the land actually are getting even older, which means that there's a lot of change that's going to happen in the world of farming, right?
That's right, and a lot of acreage is set to be transferred in the next 20 years, about 400 million acres.
Now is there an issue where there are not as many younger people who are interested in farming, or is that something that's changing as this happens?
It's a complex issue. There are less farmers. There has been, you know, increase in corporate farming, increase in mechanization of farming, specialization of crops, crop subsidies, crop insurance. The way we farm is different. More people are moving to the city. There's decreased population in our rural areas. And so there's a number, it's a complex web of reasons why. But this last survey that came out from the USDA in 2012 showed a decrease in beginning farmers, a 20% decrease.
When you say beginning farmers, does that mean, are like, if somebody's in a family and they are farming and it's handed down to them, would they be considered a beginning farmer if they take over the farm, or is that anybody who's young and takes over a farm? How does that work?
They would still be considered. It's broadly defined as anyone who's farmed for less than 10 years.
Okay.
By the USDA.
So is part of this that people don't want to stay on the farm? They go off and get jobs somewhere else?
I think there's a lot there. Again, it's a complex number of reasons. We have lost a lot of our culture around food and farming and raising a healthy culture, a healthy economy around food. And so I think that there's a lot of different ways, but a lot of this generation that is below the farmers right now are not farming. And so a lot of the new farmers are coming from with no farming background. They were not raised as farmers. A lot of them are coming from the city. And so we have a new kind of generation that's up and coming as the new farmers. So right now about 6% of the U.S. farmers are under 35.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very small amount of people. But there is a slight increase in growth from like the 25 to 35 age range. And there are a lot of barriers to get into farming if you don't come from a farming family. Aside from just the knowledge increase, there is it's capital intensive to buy land, to have money for equipment, for all of the startup capital that you need, and then to not be guaranteed to make money in the first few years of your business, it's extremely risky to get into farming, despite the fact we continue to see more and more passionate young people wanting to return to the land.
So what kind of people are you working with? I mean, you consult with people who are starting out as farmers. What kind of people are they?
Mm-hmm. There's two kind of populations of new agrarians that we're seeing. We're seeing young college graduates that have gotten degrees in other things, maybe related to the environment, maybe not, that have decided they want to be more connected to the land and to live where they work and produce food for their community. And then we're also seeing kind of the second career farmers that have worked other jobs most of their life, and they are either retired or, in their 50s, deciding that they want to go back to the land and farm. So those are the kind of two people that we're seeing. And then in general, we're seeing the general statistics is that there's an increase in women farmers, and also an increase in minority farmers in general, including about like 21% increase in Latino farmers and Asian farmers.
But do you feel that there's still a crisis in getting new people into farming, though, despite that?
Absolutely. We need many more farmers, and I think that there's a number of ways that we could incentivize new farmers and also decrease the barriers for young people getting into farming.
What needs
to happen?
There are actually a number of things I want to ask you about, but the first thing is, what do you think are some of the barriers? I mean, you talked about the expense of the land, the expense of the equipment, the fact that it's a risky business in a lot of ways because of mm-hmm. weather and things like that. Are there other issues that are creating barriers for people moving into farming?
The National Young Farmers Coalition is a group that supports young farmers, and one of their major issues right now that they're promoting and advocating for is student debt loan forgiveness. About two-thirds of our college graduates leave with student debt, and many of those young people are not able to either, take on more debt to grow the farm or access credit because of their existing student loan debt. And there's a program that exists already called the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, where that's available to doctors, nurses, teachers, government employees, some nonprofit employees.
But it's not focused on farmers.
Does not include farmers. So they're asking right now to amend this program to include farmers and to recognize farming as a public service. The program works. It forgives the loan, the federal loan, after 10 years of paying payments.
10 years of oh, okay. That makes
mm-hmm.
sense. All right.
Yep. So that's another hurdle. That's an example of a hurdle that would greatly, that would allow people to have more flexibility to invest in a new business. Connecting people to the land, there's a lot of, I think, reconnecting our culture, which includes elder farmers with new farmers, eaters with producers, urban to rural.
Is there a cultural issue, too? I mean, some older farmers are more traditional, and some of the people who are coming into new farmers are maybe a little different. Is that an issue at all in moving things forward?
Absolutely. There's definitely different cultures. It's regional. I'm based here in Minnesota in the Midwest. I work with Midwest organizations. Wendell Berry speaks to that in a great book called Unsettling of America. And I think that there definitely is cultural issues. There's generational issues, but there's nothing that can't be figured out in a respectful intergenerational land transfer. I think we need to be more creative and more and work on these solutions together to figure out how to do it. This is a huge amount of land, 400 million acres transferred in the next 20 years. This includes the health of our soil, the health of our water, the food, the health of the food that we eat. you know, this it's a major issue.
So do you in your work, do you find yourself talking to either, you know, the landowners or the family of the landowners and saying, hey, we'd like to keep this as a farm, and if you can work with us and we can get access to the land for some people who want to be new farmers, is that something that successfully happens on a pretty regular basis, or is it a challenge because of other people who want the land?
There's a number of programs in the Midwest. Renewing the Countryside has a farm transitions program with Sustainable Farming Association of Minnesota, and they work to figure out business plans and farm transfer plans that for family farms to figure out what's going to happen with their land. There's Women Caring for the Land that also works with older women landowners and how to successfully navigate conservation programs and things for their properties. And then there's the other end with the younger generation. There's many programs that support beginning farmer ranchers, and that, you know, includes the New Organic Stewards program that I've worked with. The Greenhorns is another great national organization that provides resources. They have a publication called Affording Our Land, which I would highly recommend to any new farmer. Agrarian Trust is another organization that supports land access for the next generation, and they are working with innovative investors that would like to create a, you know, resilient investment model with networks for a land movement on a larger scale.
So with all these things happening, despite the challenges of new farmers coming in, do you feel optimistic about the future of farming in the United States?
Well, you know, I get to work with beginning farmers, and so it's I can't help but not be optimistic. I am optimistic, absolutely, because these people are so passionate, so hardworking, and they are going to figure out a way to bring food to their local community, you know, and so that's it feels very hopeful to me. When I look at the ag census numbers that say there's a 20% decrease in beginning farmers, I think that's, you know, a red flag and should be a red flag to all the way up to the federal level of how can we help support this next generation in this land transfer, incentivize beginning farmers, give tax credits, increase conservation easements, make opportunities for farmland to be affordable for people who want to take care of it.
Well, Lindsay, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for highlighting this issue.
Well, that was Lindsay Reban. She's a consultant for beginning farmers and a organizer with a New Organic Stewards Project.
And if you are a new farmer or are thinking about it, we'd love to hear about your experiences. You can share them over at the Central Time Facebook page. Got a spot for you to share your thoughts, your experiences there.